When we hear that someone has had a stroke, we usually assume that there's been brain damage and the possibility of a range of debilitating losses, including the loss of speech. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk to two renowned experts about what actually happens when a person has a stroke and how strokes may be prevented. Dr. Randolph S. Marshall is the Elizabeth K. Harris Professor of Neurology and Chief of the Stroke Division at the Columbia University Medical Center. And Dr. J.P. Moore is the Daniel Sciarra Professor of Clinical Neurology at the Columbia University Medical Center. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both to today's edition of Please Explain. Dr. Marshall, we usually begin Please Explain with the most basic definitions. What is meant by the word stroke? And did doctors use that word? Because you are the chief of the stroke division at Columbia University Medical Center. So is this a technical term?
It's a term that both patients and doctors are familiar with and is used quite commonly, universally, really. Stroke is a sudden change in brain function that's caused by a vascular event.
Well, I've heard some people describe a stroke as a brain attack. Is a stroke that's caused by this vascular event, a blockage, let's say, rather than a hemorrhage, similar to a heart attack?
Yeah. Actually, that term brain attack is a useful term. I think it's only come into some use recently. The difference is with a heart attack, there's usually some pain, there's pressure in the chest. When a stroke occurs, there often is no pain, usually nothing, but an unusual change in function.
So, Dr. Moore, what are the most typical signs of a stroke? What might indicate that someone is having a stroke and needs emergency care?
Well, they have a sudden change in how they behave. Either they become unable to talk or don't seem to be making sense, or one side of the body or one of the limbs of the body suddenly appears to stop working. Or if they lose vision and complain that they can't see, or many people from injury to some parts of the brain may actually fall down, look dizzy, and appear to be having a balance attack. Any of these should alarm people around them that something could be going wrong with their brain and try to help.
But it isn't necessarily a stroke. Chuck Close, the artist, had a burst blood vessel in his spine, and everybody assumed it was a stroke until they did tests. So do you have to do tests to be sure whether it is a stroke?
Yes, you do. But actually, a blood burst vessel in the spine may actually impress upon nervous tissue and cause the effects of a stroke. Some strokes are actually caused by blood being released into the brain or spinal cord tissue, displacing the effects and making people paralyzed or having something suddenly go wrong.
So do you need to do a CAT scan or an MRI to find out whether it has been a stroke in the brain?
Yes. Ultimately, in terms of determining treatment, you need to do a CAT scan. Those two basic types of stroke that we are alluding to here, one is a blockage of a blood vessel. The other is a burst blood vessel, so a hemorrhagic or bleeding type of stroke versus a blockage. And to get to treatment, you first need to know which of those occurs because the treatments are quite different between those two.
I've heard that it is possible to have a stroke and for the causes or reasons for the stroke to remain unclear. How common is that?
That's right. Not uncommon. I mean, we're getting better at figuring out the causes, but we do a series of tests generally to look for blockage in a bigger blood vessel in the neck, for example, look for a blood clot in the heart. These are tests that we do, but sometimes we do end up with no answer.
Just commenting that the size of the brain vessels are probably not much larger than the string that the baker uses to tie up the boxes. So particles that can get into these tiny arteries or blockages of the tiny arteries are often extremely difficult to detect and find a cause for.
Since we're talking about blood vessels, is high blood pressure a signal that one might be at risk for a stroke?
Yes. There are a few, as we say, modifiable risk factors. Blood pressure is one of them, smoking, diabetes. So it actually matters. If blood pressure is high, you treat it, you reduce your stroke risk.
Didn't I just read in the Times that now some people are thinking that there could also be a viral trigger of strokes?
Yes, that's one of our colleagues, Dr. Mitchell Elkin, whose work on infectious causes of arterial inflammation may actually result in narrowing of the blood vessels and bring on a stroke. So there are a variety of common bacterial infections, some tooth infections, even some infections that involve the oral cavity, and some viruses that can set the stage for blockages. Yeah.
So if you have an infected tooth and you don't go to the dentist, you're actually putting yourself at risk for a stroke?
Well, if you don't maintain good dental hygiene, you certainly are setting the stage for bacteria to live in the recesses of the teeth and gums that can set the stage for inflammation.
I'm going to go brush right after the show.
That's right. Actually, just to amplify that a little bit, there it's often a multifactorial picture in terms of risk. So the inflammatory setting that's set up by infection may be predispose one to blood clotting or stroke.
Are headaches ever a signal with respect to the risk of a stroke?
Headache can be a cardinal signal of one particular type of stroke, a burst blood vessel or blood going into the lining around the brain. Headache can also accompany some larger strokes. But, of course, headache is so common that it's hard to isolate that as a sign for stroke that's impending.
My guests are Dr. Randolph S. Marshall, the Elizabeth K. Harris Professor of Neurology and Chief of the Stroke Division at the Columbia University Medical Center, Dr. J.P. Moore, the Daniel Scharer Professor of Clinical Neurology at the Columbia University Medical Center, and we are talking about strokes on today's Please Explain here on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dr. Moore, can you give us a simple lesson in how the brain is structured so that we can visualize the areas that may be affected by a stroke?
Well, it might sound a little hard to accept, but there are many organs in the trunk, and we don't speak of the trunk as having a site of disease. But inside the head, the brain is actually composed of a variety of very specialized sub-organs. Each of one of them does something different, and when injured, they may present the disturbance in their function and spare that of others.
And it could be in any part of the brain?
It can, yes.
I think many of us have a general idea that a stroke on one side of the brain might lead to problems on the opposite side of the body. Is that true?
Well, that's generally correct, yes. But some of the people who are expecting that a stroke will regularly cause some form of disturbance in the function of lifting an arm or leg can be wrong. Disturbance in vision, sensation, speech, language, memory, all of these can come as a consequence of stroke in different regions of the brain.
But just to add, in general, yes, for the motor function in particular, if you have a stroke on the left side of the brain, it's going to affect the right side in terms of motor function.
Is that as true of men and women? Because the brains of men and women are structured differently, and aren't women's brains more global?
Well, wait a minute. It's widely known that except for physical strength, in every other way, women are superior to men. Yeah. I certainly have to say that on NPR. So.
Yeah, especially since
I wasn't saying that as a negative.
No, I think it's a positive.
So, but it is true that there's some suggestion that that brains of women are more less lateralized, so more globally for language function, for certain functions, and that may be true, and we've learned that more through certain imaging techniques.
I gather that's a reason that some women find it easier to recover from some kinds of strokes.
Yeah, recovery, it's interesting. It's quite hard to predict who's going to recover. Most people recover from stroke to a certain degree. And predicting that is difficult.
My father had a stroke when he was 52 from smoking. We knew it even way back then. And he recovered to the point where he'd go back to work and do things, but he had lost that. He was a very strong person, and he was definitely diminished as a result. I'm not sure he was totally, very intellectually diminished, but physically he was totally diminished, and that came as a surprise to us. I would have thought it would have been loss of memory and other things, which came later.
Yeah. Well, the memory loss may be a function of having had stroke, but just in terms of recovery, Dr. Moore was mentioning earlier, you can have a very specific function that's lost, but there's also some global function that can be lost, and recovering from that is difficult too.
Are strokes more common in men than women?
The answer is, for the most part, they were, largely because of the risk factors that men indulged in for a long time.
Because men
like
used to smoke
high
more.
Blood pressure, smoking, and so forth. But the risk factors by gender are less distinct than they were thought to be a few decades ago.
Did children ever have strokes?
I'm afraid they do, and for many of them, they have inborn errors of metabolism or vascular disease in the heart, and we're very unhappy when it happens to any of them.
So there's a genetic predisposition?
Well, in some, but children are also subject to the same illnesses that affect adults. It's just that they don't have as much time on the track to build up problems with smoking, hypertension, and so forth.
What about in populations around the world? Are some places more likely, are we more likely to see strokes in certain places than others?
In general, even in this country, there are populations that have a greater prevalence of stroke. And general care, as we were talking about earlier, care with diabetes, avoidance of smoking, and blood pressure control, these are all factors that contribute. And the places where that's not as good have higher incidences of prevalence.
Diabetes because it has a vascular side?
That's right. Diabetes affects the blood vessels directly, and those in the brain can be affected just like in the eye or in the feet or in the kidneys.
Dr. Moore, what is aphasia? How common is aphasia an outcome for people who've had a stroke?
This is a term that's been around for well over 100 years. It's never been fully defined, but generally refers to disturbances in communication, either through speech or understanding or writing, that come from injury to the brain. Generally on the left side of the brain in right-handed people, but can also occur from injury on the other side.
Are there different degrees or types of aphasia depending on where the damage has occurred?
Yes. Injuries to the front part of the brain generally disturb the motor component and make it difficult for people to speak or to form sentence structures or to speak in a normal fashion. And those in the back generally have more difficulty with comprehension of things heard and things seen.
Dr. Marshall, what has actually happened in the brain? What's the basic unit of damage? Is it the cells that can't communicate with each other because tissue has been damaged?
Yeah. Generally, when a stroke occurs, there is a population of cells that die. And it's interesting, there's both a localization problem, so a particular region may be affected, but also its connections with other regions. So one part of the brain being damaged, it could be one centimeter in diameter, could be a larger area across the brain. That area is affected. Other areas may be affected by virtue of their connection with that one.
Didn't the discovery and classification of aphasias in Europe in the 19th century lead to modern concepts of localization and connectivity in the brain?
Yes.
Wow. Gee, that's interesting to have you bring that up. Yes, there was a time when it was believed that the brain's functions were so relatively isolated that they could be seen in separate subcategories. This also reflected the European idea of small principalities and isolated cities. I don't think it's as simple as that, at least as far as we can see at the present time.
But I gather Sigmund Freud was involved in all of that work.
Yes, surprisingly what? So. In fact, yes, he was in the thick of things. There was a man named Paul Broca who first identified aphasia in a frontal part of the brain. Another guy, Carl Wernicke, discovered a posterior part. And then Sigmund Freud, who most people don't recognize, was actually a good neurologist before he spun off into psychoanalysis.
Yeah, and he noticed that one of his patients was able to curse, and so he assumed this meant that an undamaged part of the brain was allowed to create these primitive concepts, and so it helped to formulate his three-part model for the brain,
the ego,
and the superego.
Does the brain know it's been injured, so to speak, and try to work around the damage?
What happens is that the brain gets affected. I mean, that's a kind of an interesting question to ask. What's the I there? Do I know that I have been damaged? Is it my brain that knows?
I'm just saying, does the body immediately start trying to find ways to work around the problem?
Immediately after the damage, we've discovered that early on, within the first few hours after injury, their backup systems in the brain, either on the other side or in areas around the stroke, may actually start taking over function. There's some redundancy and some ability for other areas to engage.
And, of course, there are therapies that have been developed.
Well, but the key point is that it was long thought that the only reason patients improved was there was a subsidence of the inflammation and swelling and things of that kind. But it's really quite clear what Dr. Marshall said, that the brain has immediately available software reprogramming mechanisms that get put into action. And to the extent that we have better insight into how this works, we should be able to control and augment them.
So what's happening is things that would have gone, if we think of it as some kind of a communication system with wires, if the wires are damaged, then the brain develops ways to connect new wires to get around the damage area.
Yeah, we like to remember the Voyager model, which when it got to Jupiter, some of its hardware packages had failed, and the computer programmers wrote new software to get the remaining products to work, and they actually brought pictures back. And this is what the brain appears to be capable of doing.
Once you've had a stroke, are you more likely to have another one?
Well, certainly by virtue of the risk factors involved, if you're a higher risk patient that has those, yes, overall a greater likelihood.
And then we hear about people having mini strokes. Are they really having mini strokes?
Yeah, so that's a term that's kind of vague. A more technical term that we use is a transient ischemic attack, so a brain attack that comes and goes quickly. That is an actual a blockage usually of a blood vessel that produces a transient change in brain function. Those may leave a mark when we go to look on an MRI or a CAT scan, and some people refer to that as mini strokes or silent strokes that have occurred in the past. Those are marks left by damage.
But the brain, like the eye and the back, have very different degrees of concentration and function. You get a needle in the eye and you won't see. You get a needle in your shoulder and you'll just shrug it off. So it depends in part upon where the injury is located and how big it is as to what the likely effects will be. So there is no general principle that can be said to apply to that.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we invite our listeners to join in the conversation at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dr. J.P. Moore, Daniel Scherer, Professor of Clinical Neurology at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Randolph S. Marshall, Elizabeth K. Harris, Professor of Neurology and Chief of the Stroke Division at Columbia University Medical Center. Again, the number 212-433-9692. We'll be back with your calls right after this. We are back with my guests talking about strokes and aphasia, Dr. J.P. Moore, Daniel Scherer. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes.
S-C-I-A-R-R-A.
That's the correct name.
Professor of Clinical Neurology at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Randolph S. Marshall, the Elizabeth K. Harris, that's easy to read, Professor of Neurology and Chief of the Stroke Division at Columbia University Medical Center. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Let's get right to one of those calls. Stacy from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? My son, when he was a month old, was diagnosed with craniosynostosis, where two of the kind of plates in his head had fused. And in the course of the diagnosis and the CAT scans and the MRIs, they determined that he'd also had two strokes that they thought was happened in utero. They referred to them as infarcts, which I don't really know. I never really understood that word. And his pediatric neurologist was kind of just, I felt very vague the whole time we were going through everything. The focus was really on the surgery for the craniosynostosis, which he had at 3 months, very successful. And with the strokes, he just would kind of say, well, you know, we just have to see how he does. We just really don't know how he's going to do, how he's going to do. He's 3 now, and he's developmentally on target. But I always sort of wonder if I should be worrying, you know, if is something going to pop up later because of these strokes? Or I just wondered if either of you had any comments on that.
Dr. Marshall?
Sure. Infarct, just to mention, that's the blockage kind of stroke. So a blood vessel was blocked. If he's doing fine now, it's unlikely that he's going to have future problems. Not knowing the whole history, it's hard to say, but most likely there was a stroke that was over and done with in utero. And what's more important is moving forward, how his blood vessels look now. And you could talk with your physician about that.
That surprises me that you can have a stroke in utero.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, blood vessels develop just like with the rest of the body and the brain in utero. And in fact, some of the abnormalities may occur. Sometimes the bleeding type of strokes actually occur before birth.
Let's go to another caller, Lewis from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My son had a brain aneurysm caused by a arteriovenous malformation. Is that considered a stroke?
Well, the answer is that aneurysms and arteriovenous malformations are disorders in development of the blood vessels.
That's AVMs, they're called?
Yes, it's called arteriovenous malformation, or AVMs, and they can be under sufficient pressure on the arterial side that the pressure can exceed the tissue resistance and leakage can occur. In the case of aneurysms, they are generally not constrained by the brain, and they can bleed freely with quite a bit of loss, and most arteriovenous malformations bleed with relatively small amounts of lost blood, and so they are related but different management problems.
Okay, thank you for calling us. We go now to Charlotte from Queens. Hi, Charlotte. You're on the air.
Hi. Great show. Thank you. My question concerns heart arrhythmias. Can they, the two parts, can arrhythmias cause strokes? And to solve that, I know there's something called catheter ablations. Can they cause a stroke to occur?
Sure. So first of all, there are different types of arrhythmias. The one that's most associated with stroke is called atrial fibrillation, and that's where, with an irregular heartbeat that occurs in one chamber of the heart. Generally, we use a blood thinner called Coumadin to treat that. There are some techniques that cardiologists use to try to stop the irregular rhythm, and when that occurs, that can lower the risk from that cause of stroke. That can be associated with some difficulty, some risk, but that treatment is not uncommon and may be an alternative that a cardiologist might propose.
Okay, thank you.
Before
we go to any more calls, I do want to cover the whole matter of what we can do to prevent strokes. Are there things? I know a lot of people are taking statins as a way of forestalling any possibility. But is this a matter of lifestyle, or is this something that is going to happen to me just because that's the way my body is built?
Unfortunately, there are some genetic components that we may not have, we don't have control over. However, there are certain things, as I was saying earlier, are modifiable risk factors, blood pressure control and so on. But statins have been shown in a number of studies to help prevent stroke after a stroke has occurred or even before one has started.
A listener wants to know if the drug Coumadin can cause strokes.
Yes, it can. If the Coumadin is used in an injudicious manner and the anticoagulant effect of the medicine is allowed to become too excessive. But in a large national study we did a few years ago, it turned out that taken properly with the proper management and the proper blood test results, the danger of serious risk from Coumadin was no greater than that of aspirin.
Let's take another. Is there a risk from aspirin?
Yes, there is, and both of them are quite small.
We go now to Roger from Westchester. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi.
You're on the air, Roger.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Bonomo, Dr. Moore, and Dr. Marshall I know as colleagues, and I just wanted to expand on one of the comments that they were asked to make. They were asked about, say, Chuck Close having a burst blood vessel in the spinal cord, and how would anybody know that that's where it was? And they went straight to the scanning answer, but I know that both Dr. Moore and Dr. Marshall would want to have the chance to examine such a person, and it's that clinical examination that really is the key to deciding whether or not somebody's got a problem in their head, whether it's a burst blood vessel or blocked blood vessel, or someplace else in the nervous system like the spinal cord.
Yes, thanks for that comment. In fact, neurologists pride themselves on being able to identify what's going on inside the head and inside the body, and the physical examination is really a key to the first encounter with a patient, and we certainly don't want to negate or reduce the importance of that.
Amen to that comment.
Even a skilled emergency room physician. Yeah,
absolutely, yes. The physical exam still lives and breathes in medicine.
Thank you so much for calling us and clarifying that. A listener left a comment on our show page wondering if there are medicines that can prevent future strokes if you've already had one.
Yes. Well, we've mentioned aspirin, we've mentioned statins, we've mentioned Coumadin. So given in certain circumstances, given appropriately, these are the medications that we use to help prevent, as we say, secondary stroke.
We go now to Pat from Richfield, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was interested, you said that there is redundant capacity that allows the brain to take over when part has been impaired. And I was wondering if there's a way of taking advantage of that capacity before a stroke.
Wow. That's an interesting question, because the implication I get from your question is that the brain is already not functioning properly, and we'd like to make it work a little harder, a little better. We've been focusing our attention on the assumption that prior to the stroke, the brain is working at its best without having been stressed by something like a stroke. And then what we try to do after the event is to see if we can find ways to help the patient reorganize the system. And Dr. Marshall can also comment on that, please.
Yeah, just certainly keeping the brain healthy and that it maintains, we believe, that capacity. Again, it's usually in response to injury that the brain reorganizes. There is some interesting literature about keeping the brain healthy and up to speed, exercising and intellectual engagement and so on.
Thank you for calling us, Pat.
Thank you.
And we go now to, oops, I'm having problems with my computer. It won't. Here I am. You know, radio was so much simpler in the old days. They just simply used to pass me a note telling me that somebody was on the line.
Right.
And now I have to rely on all sorts of, on a mouse and other things. And the mice don't always do, is it mice? The mouses don't always do what they should do. Nicholas from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you?
We're okay. And what about you?
Well, a little over 3 years ago, I had a stroke. I lost my entire right side and the full ability to speak. Fortunately, I was with a relative. We got me into an ambulance right away, and I went to Mount Sinai Medical in Astoria, which has a stroke center, and now I'm perfectly fine. I have absolutely no symptomology whatsoever at this point. And I just wanted to remind everybody how important it is to know the signs of a stroke, and if that's what anyone thinks it might be, it's necessary to give oxygen right away, because I almost went into a full coma until they realized I should be given oxygen in the ambulance. When I got to the hospital, I was given the blood thinner regime, and within a day, I had no symptoms whatsoever, and they were never really able to localize as to why I had the stroke. They did find the stroke, though. It was in my left side of my upper left lobe, but other than that, I'm fine today. Of course, I take a lot of medication, but, you know, since there are so many strokes going on these days, I think people should have more awareness as to the symptomology and, you know, the basics.
Yes, thank you. That excellent comment. Thank you very much. Because really, the key, we've talked about prevention, but in fact, if you are having a stroke and you're going to be looking for specific signs and symptoms, as you mentioned, weakness on one side of the body, sudden change in vision, sudden change in coordination or speech. These are signs that require someone to take immediate action. And as you were so lucky, I'm happy to hear your speech is quite clear, and we understood exactly what you said. But getting to the hospital within a window of opportunity to receive this clot-busting agent, the current treatment FDA-approved for treatment of acute stroke, this thrombolytic agent.
Kathy from Long Island, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was 50 years old when I was at a meeting and I had what they thought was a TIA, which turned out to be a mild stroke. They found no risk factors involved whatsoever, weight, drug taking or anything like that, except I had been taking Imitrex for migraines for several years. So my physician, Dr. Togubnik in New York City, put me on this little cocktail of coenzyme Q10, B2, magnesium, 4-mile, and a
baby aspirin every day, which I've been taking since. I do not suffer from migraines anymore, and nothing has ever happened since. And I was wondering if you could comment on that little cocktail that he was able to put me on.
That included vitamins.
Yes.
And vitamin treatments are controversial in some circles, aren't they?
Well, I think considering that vitamin treatments are generally safe and relatively inexpensive, they can't cause any harm.
And vitamin B is water-soluble, so
yes.
Even the worst that happens is you just are eliminating it.
CoQ10 and so forth. But the point that we'd like to emphasize is that you had a brief event that somebody would have been prepared to discard as an unimportant spell some years ago, but your doctors properly analyzed the problem and discovered it was really a small stroke.
In the past, what would have happened if they hadn't diagnosed it correctly?
They were often considered to be a minor event, but somewhere on the order of 19% to 20% of these people will have a real stroke followed in the first week or so after that event. So it is important to report, even with the spell being brief. We wish we could comment favorably on all the medicines that you were given, and we're glad that they seem to be working at least not against you, but possibly for you.
One of the big problems in doing these kinds of conversations is that we don't have the X-rays, we don't have the medical history, and so your guess is as good as mine.
Well, also, we don't wish to be making comments concerning sponsors who might be happy to take advantage of the remarks that we have made.
Ah, okay. We go to Sylvia from Scotch Plains. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, hello. About a month ago, I was visiting a friend in New Paltz, and I woke up one morning with a terrible pain on the right side of my head, as if someone had actually hit me on the head. And I drove home sort of, you know, very nervous about the pain. And by the time I got to the doctor, which was a few days later, we did all the eye-hand coordinating thing, but nothing happened. And she sent me for a blood test, an eye exam, nothing was detected, but eventually the pain subsided, but it felt like something, my right eye, even as I'm speaking to you now, feels as if it was affected. Was that a mini stroke? And what would have caused such a terrible pain?
It's hard to know exactly from the story, but pain is something we do take seriously. If it's localized, it could be a sign of an injury to a blood vessel.
Because her eye has been affected. So that would suggest there's more than just I had a headache.
Was there loss of vision as well? I think it was just the pain in the eye. But so yes, it could be a sign of a carotid artery dissection or injury.
And we've run out of time, unfortunately. But I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us and being so helpful. Dr. Randolph S. Marshall is Elizabeth K. Harris Professor of Neurology and Chief of the Stroke Division at Columbia University Medical Center. And Dr. J.P. Moore is the Daniel Shara Professor of Clinical Neurology at the Columbia University Medical Center. And it's been a fascinating Please Explain. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, we'll talk to New Yorker staff writer Michael Spector about why so many Americans have come to mistrust science and major institutions. And then biographer Will Haygood on the life of the great boxer Sugar Ray Robinson. Also Thomas Keller, the chef owner of Per Se and the French Laundry, talks about his latest cookbook, Ad Hoc at Home. And Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman discusses his new documentary, The Card Game, about the future of the consumer loan industry. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we have help today from Ida Sadakiani and contributing producer Bonnie Lefebvre. Dimitri Krasny was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.